The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
We have a tight schedule this afternoon, so I'm going to go ahead and start our panel on technology and some of the challenges in using it. I'm Ken Hirsch. I'm the director of the Law Library and Information Technology at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. And I'd like to give relatively brief biographies of our panelists so we can move into discussion. Sitting to my right is Sharon Krever Weisbaum. She's a partner at Brown, Goldstein, and Levy. She received her JD from the University of Maryland School of Law, and she represents individuals with disabilities and their families who require services or support from the state or federal government, and for those who require accommodations from employers or service providers. She also advocates for special education and support services for children and their families, and for developmental and mental health services for adults. Sharon serves as counsel or in an advisory capacity to disability advocacy organizations throughout Maryland and is often asked to speak at annual conferences and training programs. She has served on the faculty of the National Leadership Consortium on Developmental Disabilities at the University of Delaware and speaks regularly for the Maryland Association of Community Services. She and her firm represented the National Federation for the Blind in its action against Arizona State University regarding mandated use of the Kindle DX, and that suit was resolved by settlement about a year ago, and she'll be telling us more about that. Sitting next to Sharon is Gary C. Norman, an attorney, mediator, and founder of Norman Access and Conflict Resolution Consultants Group. He is also a commissioner on the Maryland Commission on Human Relations, having been appointed back in January. Gary is a former president of the Maryland Area Guide Dog Users, an advocacy and education-based nonprofit that he established. He received his JD from Cleveland Marshall College of Law and is a 2011 candidate for a Master of Letters of Law with specialization in health law right here at Washington College of Law. He's a forthcoming book chapter on the law of service animals that will be published in a book out by the American Bar Association later this year. And he also has two forthcoming articles that will be published in the Encyclopedia of American Disability History. And at the other end of the table is Brian Rapp, who is the Assistant Director of Technology right here at the College of Law, where his responsibilities include managing and developing its websites and related applications. He attended American University in the School of Public Affairs and has worked here at the law school for the past 6 years. Brian has been developing websites for over 15 years with a strong emphasis on the academic sector as well as on web standards and accessibility. He's presented at the Center for Computer Assisted Legal Instruction, or CALI's annual conference. And Washington College of Law's homepage, for which he's responsible, was recently noted among only 8 law schools for a perfect score of measured accessibility elements under Section 508 in the survey on top 10 law school home pages of 2010, recently published by Jason Eisman and Roger Skalbeck. I'm going to be asking some questions, but generally the speakers are free to talk about their topics, and we'll try to take some questions from you. But if we should run out of time, the speakers have agreed to stay beyond our time, so a little later this afternoon, if you want a chance to meet with any of them, you certainly may. So let me start with Sharon. Sharon, tell us the crux of the National Federation for the Blind's complaint about higher education's mandatory adoption of e-readers such as the Kindle.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So our firm represents the National Federation of the Blind. I say of and not for, because it is really an organization of blind members. And I will talk about the Kindle and suits, and I can talk about any of the other lawsuits. I was sitting at lunch, and I know our firm might not be the most popular with some of the universities here because of some lawsuits that are pending. But let me explain kind of where the NFB is coming from. The education is drastically changing, as everyone here knows, and you all know more than I do about how technology is changing education at the college level, at the K-12 level, and obviously at the graduate school, law school level. the way professors are interacting with students, the way students access library materials, how they access course materials. It's all technology. We came upon college students at various schools who could not access the curriculum because of the boom in technology. That's why the NFB has been so aggressive in the last 2 years, because if the technology is inaccessible to people who are blind and students with other print disabilities, the blind are going to be further and further behind. And the NFB feels, you know, passionate about this. So, in 2009, members of the something called the Reading Rights Coalition, which includes the NFB, it also includes about 26 other disability rights groups representing people with various types of print disabilities, sued Arizona State as well as filed complaints to the federal government. From those complaints, and this was about the e-reader, the Kindle, because schools were using the Kindle for classes, and at that time the Kindle was not an accessible product. So that meant the students that were going to be in those classes, who were blind or had other print disabilities, weren't going to be able to access the materials. The Departments of Education and Departments of Justice investigated the complaints that we filed and reached settlements with all of the schools. And the settlements require or prohibit schools from purchasing, requiring, recommending, or promoting the use of any e-book reader that is not fully accessible to students with vision disabilities. The point of these lawsuits are is to push the market, the developers of these products, forward. The customers are the schools and the colleges and the K-12 and the graduate schools. That's why we are going after the schools, because it's the schools that can put the pressure on the developers to make accessible products. I was in a civil yesterday in mediation. I represent two college students, and we have a complaint at the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights because those two college students cannot access any math course at the college because it's all online, and the online program that that college has is inaccessible. What I mean is it does not work with their school readers. Not only is it inaccessible, they told the students they can't make Braille books. They couldn't give them a Braille textbook. That means my clients, these young students, could not take the math class because it's totally inaccessible. We are trying very hard to work that case out. If not, it will be in federal court.
Sharon, since you mentioned course materials, are major courseware vendors such as Blackboard working hard to meet accessibility requirements?
Blackboard, yes. The learning management systems, we have a patent complaint that has gotten a file in the press against Penn State because of a lot of systemic access barriers. But one of the access barriers that our clients found was that the learning management system was not accessible. So the students couldn't talk to their professors, couldn't do collaborative work that other students could do. Blackboard, for instance, and there are a few others, is a learning management program that is accessible. They've worked hard with the NFB technical people to make that product accessible. So I think their latest version, yes, is. So there are alternative accessible products out there. What we're trying to do is, through the market pressures, get all of the products, or as many as possible, accessible.
Gary, how does the ADA affect organizations which impose examinations on credentialing requirements such as boards of state bar examiners and the national organization that, that they use their products of?
I'm sorry. I just wanted to commend Associate Dean David and Myra and all of the students here who I've found very often to be very disability-friendly, very easy individuals to work with, as well as our staff and our wonderful logistical people and volunteers here today. And thank you to my fellow colleagues Sharon and Brian and Ken for speaking with me today. I would only build on Sharon's remarks first that often costs are much higher at the rear end as they are at the front end. So we need to continue to push the market in the right direction to engage in what people could more eloquently describe as universal design than me, to make sure that it's not a rear thought but a beginning thought when you come to assistive technology and accessibility issues. Sharon has worked extensively on the issue of bar exams to answer Ken's question, but my colleague, who's been a deputy of mine on many projects, Joshua Friedman, and I have an article coming out in the Maryland Bar Journal on the issue of bar exams. And I think the sentiments of our article really are that obviously every person, disabled or not, has to meet the criteria for the bar exam. But the problem is when the bar examiners believe that they can dictate what accommodations you receive, there seems to be a certain illogic that the bar examiners could come back and say, well, you have to use a human reader, or you have to use this very limited type of technology that we prescribe for you, when it's usually not the assistive technology, often namely in chair and suit, screen readers, and a type of enlarger software called ZoomText that they've used in law schools. And we believe that a fair interpretation, I think, Sharon, you could correct me if I'm wrong, NFB's interpretation, and as well as the firm's view of the issue, is that the ADA should be read liberally in that context to ensure that people can kind of use the accommodations that they have the best experience with, because that ensures meeting the ADA's standards of accessibility. Sharon, do you have any comments on that?
Well, the one thing I guess I would share is the standard that just recently the Ninth Circuit upheld, which is a standard that is in the Justice Department regulations on testing. Now, this is by private entity testing, that the examination has to kind of best ensure that when the examination is administered to an individual with a disability, that the results reflect the individual's aptitude and achievement rather than reflecting the individual's disability. So it's this best ensure standard. So in the case that my colleague is talking about, Mr. Elder needed the screen reader so that he could, that was his normal accommodation that he always uses to take tests. And he doesn't use readers, you know, human readers. And so that was upheld by the Ninth Circuit, because that best ensures that you're testing the right thing.
Let me turn towards legal education for a moment. Certainly those of you who've been to law school will recall that in all 1L classes and many upper classes, the one evaluative tool used by the faculty is an end-of-term comprehensive exam. And despite the presence of the honor code, or a variant of it, at most institutions, law schools, when making the move from the case 10 years ago when taking exam by computer was the exception to today when taking exam by computer is the norm, would not let that happen until they could have specialized software that would virtually lock down a student's computer during the exam. Now, for any of the panelists, what is your experience on the use of that software? And there are basically four manufacturers of the software in the United States with relation to accessibility issues. Has there been an issue, or is that software relatively friendly?
What I would say is that my exams, we have worked out a system by which the professor provides the exam materials to Myra and to David, and it's put on a flash drive or a junk drive, as it's called, too, sometimes. and then I use a computer that's equipped with JAWS. We've tried to avoid using the exam software I think you're talking about,
right,
just because
in your
it
case,
seems
yes.
to have some accessibility issues with JAWS.
Brian, did you want to add something to that?
Yeah, what usually happens is after the student takes the exam, we work with the exam software manufacturer, and they reformat the exam so that it looks just like any other exam. So the professor doesn't know that the student took it in a different method than any other student.
Yes, and for those of you who also may not remember, anonymity and grading is a key component of law school. And one would think that that using computers would certainly support that, if assuming a faculty member hasn't had enough exposure to a particular student's writing to recognize the handwriting at exam time. Brian, let me continue with you. Tell us what's involved in making a website that's compliant with Section 508.
Well, there's quite a few things that go into it, but nowadays a lot's shifted in web design trends. A few years ago, the idea was just to make something that looked right on your screen. And in the past few years, it's shifted towards semantic markup, making a page that actually has some meaning to it so that your headers are actually headers. And this isn't just for accessibility reasons, but because Google, other machine reading type services look at the page, and they aren't viewing it on a screen either, they'll be reading that same information. So I think that's benefited accessibility quite a bit. One of the main issues is images on a web page. You can provide alternative descriptions for any image that you see on a web page. So somebody who doesn't see images, who has a screen reader, will see that text instead of the image. A lot of websites skip over that fact so that when somebody comes to it with a screen reader, they'll get a blank image. Major other issues right now are video. Video is a difficult subject to tackle with accessibility. Google's made some good advances with YouTube. Right now they have some automated voice-to-text captioning systems in beta. It isn't quite perfect yet, but they're making some great strides there. Other accessibility issues are forms are a major issue. Traditionally, you would kind of lay it out so that looking at it on a screen, you would see a label next to a form field. But in the HTML markup, a lot of times they were totally separate parts of the page, so that a screen reader wouldn't necessarily know which field went with which label. But you can design, if you start from scratch that way, you can design it so that forms are associated with particular labels and particular fields, and that can make a significant difference.
I would build on Brian's comments. Another issue that I think any person who's visually impaired experiences, not only law students, are PDF files, and it seems to be that there needs to be some education in how you structure it, because evidently it really has to be built on the front end, like I was talking about, trying to incorporate accessibility on the front end of issues. And PDFs are really improving with the later versions of JAWS and Adobe, but there's still some room for improvement sometimes.
Yeah, Adobe made a commitment to PDFs and to Flash a few years ago to try and increase the accessibility of both of them. Just to give you an example, usually a document that comes out of a word processor and converted to a PDF will generally turn out better than a lot of PDFs that are generated via scanned-in documents, which a lot of times they aren't even OCR, which is optical character recognition, where it looks for the letters in a document. So if somebody has that type of document with a screen reader, they're just going to get an image which has no associated text with it.
I was just going to comment that for those of you who are involved in, let's say, web design issues, or if you're one thing that I think lots of institutions do is they forget to have a person with the disability, if we're talking about print disability or whatever the disability is be part of kind of that testing program, so that the blind individual tests what you all think is an accessible website, because so many times sighted people are testing it, and they are just not able to pick up the glitches that the blind tester picks up as soon as he touches the, you know, the program. So if that can be built in, again, front end on software, on everything we've been told, kind of fixing it afterwards, fixing the building and having to put an elevator in, or, you know, the ramp in that no one put in, obviously it's the same concept. So on the front end, when you're designing whatever technology we're talking about, I think having the person with people with disabilities that would be affected by this really should be part of the testing.
And a sighted user can determine probably about 90% of the problems themselves just using a text-based browser. Lynx is an older one. A few years ago, we had an intern working with us, and he was designing something, and I realized quickly that it wasn't going to be accessible, and so I told him to spend the day browsing the web with Lynx so that he could see the web in text form. And that was kind of an eye-opening experience for him to realize, you know, all these little holes add up to being a giant hole.
And I think kind of building on Brian and Sharon, I think there's something to be said about kind of the law part, but as you try to implement it on a day-to-day basis, really building relationships. I should have mentioned before, Brian and his colleagues should be recommended. I think that poll that report that Ken mentioned really is accurate. My experience with what we call MyWCL has been quite positive as a blind user. So really the staff should be quite commended at the law school. And my experience with trying to educate our IT people at work is it really requires a certain kind of day-to-day personal contact. A lot of IT people really are very open to learning some of these issues, and it just requires a very collaborative process on both ends.
And just to explain what MyWCL is, it's our learning management system / announcement kind of community system, but it's built on Microsoft SharePoint. We're on 2007 right now. So even the large vendors like Microsoft are, you know, taking great care to try and make their products accessible too.
To any of the panelists and all of you, what besides websites, what are some of the other challenges of ensuring accessibility to reading materials to law students?
I think maybe I could address that. I could give a brief history of how it's changed over time, just as our society has changed, technology speaking. When I was in, I should back up, like Isaac, who spoke this morning, I have probably a similar condition called RP, so there's various forms of it, but essentially, usually people lose their vision over a period of time. So for me, as I progressed through grammar school, high school, and then post-secondary education, my needs to information technology and access information have evolved over time, just as technology has. And I started off when I could see much better with a very kind of large print that was probably 16-18 font. But by the time I was in high school, and unfortunately, I didn't always know my needs to become a good self-advocate, as Andy and a lot of people talked about this morning. I tried to press that kind of access way longer than it was really beneficial. So then I progressed into using audio tape, which was state-of-the-art then, to get audio books from organizations like Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic. And then, as I noticed as I got into college, there was this really novel new thing called JAWS, which was a few years old by the time I started college in the early 90s, and I was open to a whole new world of kind of the computer industry and some of the blind people who were leading the charge for access to computers. And by the time I was in law school, I was facing the issue, as I think many law students with any kind of reading challenges to print or standard print information, I needed to use and deal with the publishers to get CDs or books on CD. To now, we're here at MyWCL and the law school, I'm using PDFs and trying to access documents from Westlaw and using a lot more interactive type reading materials.
I think one of the things I think people sometimes forget is they can work on a website at a university, and they can make the website accessible. But then what is posted on the website, and what, let's say, if you're at a college and there are all these different departments, so you have all sorts of people posting. Well, the posting, the content, could just all of a sudden, you know, make it an inaccessible experience again. So what we are talking to universities about are guidelines for, you know, who, not so much who can post, but for all the people that do post, guidelines, resources for those people, because many of them are professors who wouldn't know anything about accessibility, technically. Other places, these, well, I call them clickers. I think you told me a better name.
Well,
Their formal name is personal response devices.
People
commonly call them clickers, thinking back to the 30 years ago to mechanical remote controls, and of course today nothing clicks.
So, but these personal communication devices, clickers, what clickers are being are used for all over the place, and whether they're used in law schools, I'm not sure, but certainly in undergrad. It's an attendance way to know if the student is there, and it's also a way to take pop quizzes. It's also a way to answer bonus questions, you know, and just a whole participation. So the students, and there are accessible clickers on the market, but there are also inaccessible clickers. So universities, and buy them at the school store, you know, the bookstore. Well, if the brand student cannot access it, then they're, you know, they can't participate in the same way. Registration processes we've seen inaccessible. The professors, the smart podiums that every school, I guess, has now, we've had faculty can't access it because it's touch and it's not tactile based, so they need to get a helper. What other places are we seeing? The library system itself has been very problematic in places. So those are some of the issues that we have seen and we're trying to work with universities to address.
And just to add one to your list, digital signage, which is used in a lot of places. If that information isn't posted somewhere else that's accessible, you know, your audience, part of your audience may be missing it completely.
Let me ask the panel this question. And I'm phrasing on the fly, so forgive me if I don't quite get it right. It's regards to law school pedagogy. Going back to the Langdalian casebook and Socratic discussion, which is very, one reads and one listens and talks, but that's it. So if you can get your text in a form you can listen to, the professor's not showing you anything, you're supposed to be listening to the professor. Are there changes in current law school pedagogy that are making it more difficult for students to have accessibility to what they're supposed to be learning? Anyone?
My colleagues?
I think to some degree. There are still some professors who teach in that method, but there are a lot now that we see using multimedia. You know, watch this video clip, you know, tell me, you know, what you're seeing on the screen. Unless they provide an explanation of what's going on the screen, a blind student's not going to be able to contribute to that discussion. I mean, I think that's just a major one, is people think they're adding a little bit of pizzazz to their class, but in a lot of ways they may not really be adding that much and just adding hindrances for some students.
And going back to clickers, the most common way to use the personal response devices is that the manufacturers build their software to work with Microsoft PowerPoint. So the faculty member will build a slideshow with the questions built in, and those questions can range from, as said, simple ways to take attendance to a pop quiz to just to gauge how whether the class is understanding the material. So at that point, it becomes incumbent upon either the professor or the professor's assistant, if they're aware that there is a person with sight issues in the class, to add an audio component to the slideshow, which will then enable the student to understand what the contents of the slide are. But again, the faculty members or the assistant building the slides has got to remember to take that affirmative step.
And I think that's all true, Ken. But I think one issue that I've experienced is, you know, sometimes professors kind of hand out paper-based materials and forget that I'm visually impaired. So I think it requires a little bit of self-initiative on the part of the blind law student, in my case an LLM student, to build a relationship and pick out really good professors who are very disability friendly. And I've been very fortunate here. The director of my component of the program is very open to learning about these issues. So when that happens, you know, I have to kind of, well, you know, email me the materials.
That raises a question. I wonder if any law school on there, and everybody uses student evaluations of faculty, has a disability accessibility question that they ask students to complete regarding their faculty in their classes, or if they don't, would it be worthwhile adding it?
I don't think we do have that here, and if we don't, I would encourage
it. I'm unaware of anybody who does currently, but not to say there isn't, but I've not seen it.
You know, I wanted to say the accessibility, technology is actually the hope, and I think it will be with a little more pushing. Technology can kind of open up and be a mainstream tool for people with disabilities, as long as it's built correctly on the front side. So the NFPA, for instance, just loves the fact that technology is being implemented at every level of education, you know, from the kindergarten through the, you know, medical school, law school, because then you don't have this separate system to go to the disability services office and rip apart books and get them scanned in, and that whole separate process of getting your books late, because it's always been separate and unequal, because it just isn't as good. So technology opens the possibility for totally mainstream and totally equal. So I don't want anyone to think that the NFB is down on the technology. They love it. The members love it, as long as we can get the developers of the technology with the program to make sure it's accessible. It can, you know, there are technical solutions to all of it. It's just I don't think most people think that way. And so it's a culture shift.
And let me ask you about that. We know that litigation is the stick for the developers. What are some of the carrots to get them thinking about it at the front end?
I think seemingly there could be an argument that it costs lesser on the front end. There may not be enough of this, but we can certainly find avenues in the tax code and different kinds of financial incentives for companies to think about issues of the universal design much more proactively than they do sometimes now. Although, as Brian's mentioned, there are a lot of large named corporations like Microsoft that really are and have shown a great interest and a great dedication to moving much more positively forward on these issues.
Yeah, I think some of the biggest problems you find are in the smaller development shops, where resources are fairly limited, so they tend to whittle down which features they'll support fairly quickly, and unfortunately accessibility is oftentimes one of those features that they don't think is important enough. So unless people are asking about it, making it a requirement to get certain types of software, it really is going to continue to be ignored. So you can use money in that way too. If I'm not going to buy your software, I'll buy your competitors because they are accessible.
Which is what, you know, I think we've been pushing. Google and Microsoft at the K-12 level and for the last couple, really in the last 12 months, are giving all this Google Apps and Microsoft Live, I think it's called, all free products to schools. Now, why? I mean, there's no cost to the schools because they want to be in the little child's brain, and then the family, and then you start buying all the apps, and you know they have business reasons. You're going to hear a lot over the next week about Google Apps because they're not accessible. It's an issue, and it's ballooning everywhere. So I think you'll hear more soon. But these are like the calendaring, the Gmail, the Google Docs, collaborative learning. That's a big deal these days from what I understand as far as, you know, different ways that teachers are teaching. And I'm not sure about the law school level, but certainly in the undergrad. So that documents are shared and you can write beautiful things among classmates and they can share them. Well, that's great, except if you're not able to access it. So that kind of learning is tremendous, and we want it. Just want to make sure everyone can participate.
What about outside the classroom and offices such as career services and professional development and other offices? Where do you think things stand with regard to technology and the disabled at law schools?
you all know?
I think a lot of the career services do okay because they're dealing mainly with databases in a similar way to a lot of libraries. Events, it does get trickier. One issue we've tried to tackle here is sometimes people send out emails as image attachments because they have a nice poster.
Yes.
But they don't provide any alternative text. So somebody who can't see that image, either you know because they're blind or because they're on a mobile device that doesn't show images, gets an empty email. So those sorts of educational hurdles, I think we have to get people on board on that end. It's not so much that they can't do it, it's just that they don't necessarily know that they should do it.
I agree with Brian.
I thought for a moment, I accidentally did this earlier today, but I'll do it on purpose now. For those of you who haven't heard what a particular device's screen reader might sound like, I've got my iPad here, and I will for a moment let the Apple calls it the VoiceOver app read you the introduction I read a little earlier today, and we'll see how we'll listen to what it sounds like. And when you're tired of it, it seems to take me many steps to turn it off, so bear with me. So first, we get to a third screen and turn it on. And the speaking rate...
Settings.
The speaking rate is rather fast, although I do have it set for nearly as slow as it will go. Now let me go back to that introduction.
Good reader. Double tap to open.
Or in front of his fireplace. The slate was an alternative.
Good reader. Discussion questions.
Sorry.
For workshop.
I changed his plane.
Disabilities
too.
Workshop. Back button.
75 pounds. Half a mother.
That's Tom and Ray. We don't want to hear them.
Doc. I thought. Landscape. Home button to the right. Pause. Button. Pause. Button.
Now, back to that. Sorry.
Home.
And this is a sighted person having this difficulty, so you can imagine it's going to be more complex for somebody who is not sighted. Now we'll try again with
the introduction. Sharon, tell us the crux of the NFB's complaint about higher education's adoption of e-readers such as the Kindle.
And that's slow.
I would agree.
Right?
I would
that's
agree.
Very slow for, I mean,
Sharon.
And you can adjust the...
Although I'm getting older, so I seem to read less fast than I used to.
I look forward to participating with all of you. My guest, Sharon KW.
Oh, that's me.
That's part of an email. So now I'm turning it off.
And remember, for instance, a blind lawyer in my office, so he sits a couple of doors down from me. Now, he uses JAWS. Now, he has a headphone on and plugged it in, so I never hear it, just so you know, that's what happens. But that's how he does all of his legal work.
I would say when I'm at home and I'm writing my papers like I am to finish my program here, my wife says, you're spending more time with JAWS than you are downstairs with me.
I'm going to ask if any of you had something you wanted to add before we open up for questions.
I'll add one thing. There is a June, I think it's dated June 29th, 2010, letter from the Justice Department and the Department of Education Office of Civil Rights. It's a letter that went to all college presidents, university and college presidents. You can get it on the website, or you can email me and I'll send it to you. But it came after the Kindle complaints were settled. But it's a letter that details under the law why all about technology and obligations of public universities, private universities. It would be my contention under the ADA in Section 504 that would apply not just to the colleges, but to the school districts, to the, you know, all educational institutions. So I think it's a very helpful letter to read, June 29, 2010, from Perez and Ali.
Let me ask you a question, since you mentioned that letter. There is a list of law school technologists called the Technoids List, and when that letter was released, there was some, I'll use the term pushback, even though that might be a little strong. Has any of you run into pushback in the technology, either the technology folks at law schools or non-disabled users pushing back at the need to make accommodations?
I can only speak from the technology side. At least internally for us, I don't think we've had any sort of feelings of frustration or anger or anything about having to do this. It's just part of, you know, providing service to the students, no matter who the student is. From the students, I haven't really heard any complaints about, you know, why does this student get to take the exam at a different time or anything like that? Because under certain circumstances, they're also offered, you know, accommodations. If they have too many exams in one time period, they're allowed to spread them out too.
I would agree with Brian. I think all the students here have, if anything, been truly curious about assistive technology like JAWS, for instance, type issues. Like I said, I would say the majority of professors here are pretty eager to learn about the issues. So it continues to need some of the personal relationship type building. At work, it's sometimes been a mixed bag, but I think that's true of society. And it requires maybe a mixture of tools, whether it's Sharon's more legalistic approach or if it's a more personal approach or somewhere in between. Hopefully over time, I've educated some people at work about what accessibility issues are and how I need them to do my job as a blind attorney.
And the only pushback that we've seen is from the institutions is saying that the products aren't accessible, so what do you want us to do? And what we want you to do is be the, you know, press and be the customer and push the market. That's what we want you to do. That's why we're looking for procurement of the government and the, you know, the local school districts who are spending millions and millions and millions of dollars on technology to put it in their procurement specs as a requirement, a condition like other conditions.
Yes.
Hi. I have two.
Could you identify yourself?
Sure. I'm Carol First. I'm the Dean of Students at Seton Hall Law School. And in relation to pushbacks, I have two scenarios. I'm just interested in the panel's comments or if anyone else here has dealt with this and come up with good solutions. I don't know if anyone has experience with the smart pen. I have one student who was granted use of the smart pen for recording lectures and as an accommodation for his disability. I have professors who do not and will not record their classes unless it's been specified that recording is accommodation for disability. I have other students with disabilities who've now discovered the smart pen either through the student or on their own and are not permitted to use it in class. While disability support, the committee has advised me that these students don't need it as an accommodation, it would be helpful. So they haven't gone as far to say it's something that we have to provide as a reasonable accommodation, but they said, oh, it would be really helpful for them. And I can't get these professors who don't want to be recorded to agree to be helpful. The second thing is professors who ban laptops in the classroom. I have two students who use CART, one for a learning disability, the other for hearing impairment. When they are in, and these are, unfortunately, both of these situations have come up in required courses where a property professor does not allow laptops in the classroom, so the person who uses CART is then singled out as the one person in class with a laptop. The person has otherwise sort of remained anonymous and hasn't really had to identify themselves as a person with a disability to his or her classmates and really wants to remain anonymous, but it just wasn't possible and the teacher wasn't willing to be flexible. Her solution was, well, why don't we say that everyone in the class can have access to the transcription that CART provides to the student, but that was a violation of the licensing agreement with CART, so we couldn't do that. So I'm just curious if anyone had to solve similar problems or feedback or anything you guys can help out with.
I think my experience in law school round one, as I like to call it, when I got my JD at Cleveland Marshall, and I was much more likely to tape record classes back then because I didn't or wasn't using a laptop with JAWS on it. I would record many classes, but I did encounter many professors who were just truly ignorant of the law and not decent people to deal with. But the majority of the law students and the professors at CM were very great to deal with. Now here it seems like even not in terms of a disability issue only, it just seems like professors are a little more amenable to recording classes just for a variety of reasons. When people miss class or if there's a rescheduled class, it seems to happen a lot more that there is some more type recording, and it seems like the professors deal with the IT department on that issue, right, Brian?
Yeah, we see a few different, opinions on recordings. There are some professors who, if anybody requests a recording, whether they're absent or not, then they'll make that recording available to the entire class. And there are other students who will work with student affairs so that if it is an accommodation request, only that student gets access to that recording. And then we have other professors who record every class for every student, and they're open to it. But for the professors that don't want to be recorded in general, especially in an environment where you have to have the recording device in the room, that is especially tricky. Here, we're fortunate that a lot of the rooms can be remotely recorded, so the students wouldn't necessarily know that particular session of class is being recorded at that time.
That's what I was thinking.
If I could offer, I don't know that these work. I haven't seen anyone try them very successfully. With regard to the situation you mentioned with the smart pen, depending upon the rationale of the professor, you might be able to persuade the professor and the student to have a written agreement where the student expressly agrees to only use it for my own personal use, and I promise not to release it to anyone else, which I think most faculty who object to recording are afraid of potential later use of the material, especially if it's a bad performance day. But likewise, they legitimately have copyright claims to everything they're saying in the classroom, so they might be concerned about that as well. The laptop issue is frankly a pain in both non-disabled and disabled applications. There are some faculty who just refuse to do it or will say, why can't the technology folks turn off the wireless? But it's so much broader. As a technologist for many years at Duke, we were asked many times, why don't you shut off the wireless? And we said, well, to begin with, it'll be expensive because they don't do it anywhere else on campus this way, so you'll need new equipment. And we would say, why don't you tell your class to shut the laptops or don't bring them in? You're the professor, it's your classroom. But when you come down to them, that obviously doesn't address the situation where there's a special case where they will allow the disabled student to use a laptop but not anyone else, which then also raises in my mind, and I'm no expert on this, but whether that creates a FERPA issue by identifying that student's disability in front of the whole class.
David Jaffe, Washington College of Law. I want to try a further response, and then I have a question or observation for the panel. We've had a similar issue, and I would say fortunately and unfortunately, a student in this situation ultimately decided to forego use of the laptop, and you can see both sides. It made it easier for us, but we actually wanted to push the envelope, and we had it taken out of our hands. One of our proposals had been, and I don't know if this would work in this case, would be to strongly suggest, if not tell, with the support of your university council, that the professor is going to expand the use of laptops in that class by one or two, meaning so that the CART student is covered, the student who's looking not to be outed is covered, and then one or two other students, totally at random, through your choosing, are also entitled to have a laptop. And that way, that student has a protection. It's not going to the entirety of the class. It's kind of a compromise to some degree with the professor, and I think the support of council kind of saying, I'm not sure about whether it's thou must, but there's some language that if they'll get you back might help to some degree. So another thought. I'm listening to some of the comments, and I think I'm torn, kind of something that has come up. Brian and Gary both mentioned our use of exam software. We've generally been very happy with the software in particular because it resolved one of our issues in working with students with disabilities, which is that for a number of our faculty, in the absence of the exam software, they're going to go back to handwriting only, and then we have the issue with students who cannot, for a number of reasons, take their exams by hand. We've been fortunate with the software we use that there is a workaround when we need it, but that gives us the out to not have to force a vendor at the front end to take a hard look at the inaccessibility. And so I say this in part as an observation, in part, and I can see different folks on the panels having different responses to it. Should we be taking a more, you know, kind of line in the sand approach, which is until we get this worked out, we're going to, now, this may answer the question, find another competitor that has, or find some other way to resolve it, or really push them, or should we be comfortable in the fact that the workaround is not onerous to the students, and we think that it's not, and it certainly is working for us in terms of kind of the balance with the with other students who might be affected as a consequence. So
it's my experience at the two law schools I've experienced with that the typical response is to let the disabled student not use the software, and they're going to take the exam at a time different. Now the cases I'm thinking of, they also have the accommodation of extra time for the exam, so they're not going to sit in the room at the same time. Given that there are roughly 200 accredited law schools in the United States, and there are basically four vendors of this software, Secure Exam, ExamSoft, Extegrity, and Electronic Blue Book. And I actually don't know what, if any of them, provide accessibility. I rather doubt it, because in locking down the screen, every time you introduce a new variable, it makes the program more complex, and as I'm sure Brian and his colleagues know, every time you get a new version of the software, you're on pins and needles because, yeah, you test it, but basically every new exam season is a beta test, and there's no one in the world more sensitive to something going wrong with their computer than a student taking a make or break exam. Right. So in support of disabled students, I would argue, one side of me would argue, push the vendors, but the other side of me says, are you going to introduce some new variable that's going to screw up the software? So it's got to, you've got to insist likewise that it be very thoroughly tested. And, you know, the testing is the part that's really hard to push when you have such a small market. It's if I just want to say one thing, despite what one would think, there aren't a lot of higher educational institutions outside of law schools using restricted exam software because there aren't a lot of institutions besides law schools which have so much riding on that one piece of work.
And I think because of how that software works, it's especially tricky because any sort of accessibility would have to be built into the software. It couldn't rely necessarily on JAWS or another program running because those programs prohibit those sorts of programs from running. And then you're also dealing with the cross-platform issue. You know, it was a big struggle to get a lot of these software companies to support Macs. So now that quite a few of them do, you know, any support they build in would have to probably be supporting both operating systems, both Windows and Macs, let alone Linux or other operating systems.
I would think that, I mean, we're usually not in favor of workarounds because it doesn't change behavior. And many times, although you said it's fairly simple on this one, but many times workarounds aren't good for really kind of high-tech people. But the lay, you know, the English major who's now in law school, who's not real techie, has a harder time. So, but is there a way, and, you know, I know there's obviously competition among law schools, just like in anything else, but is there, are there coalitions that could work together to put that market pressure on this limited number of companies? And even with a three-year plan, you know, so that there is, you could get an accessible product by year three. That's still a lot of pressure, especially if there are a lot of law schools. So we have not had a, I have not actually, heard, I know that these restrictive exams take, you know, software, but I haven't had a client, you know.
Yeah, I agree with Sharon. I think there's really, for you, Dave, you have to work both ends and be strategic. I think your perspective is different than an advocate. You have to try to work for all the various cross populations of disabilities. Some disabilities might be benefited from the software as me. I'm not sure how well I'll ever be able to use that software with JAWS. So if you could work through that coalition and do some capacity building with the industry on the one hand, but also try to be proactive in working with the students to try to meet their needs, I think that's the best approach for you.
Gary, let me ask you a question that comes out of my own personal ignorance as to, you know, what it's like to not have sight. When you're typing an exam, the act of typing itself doesn't require sight because you know what the keyboard is. Are you, but are you trying to get feedback as to, just like I would want to go back up and see what I typed the sentence before? Is that the kind of thing you're dealing with, or is it more than that?
I think that's a good question. I think there's actually, beyond just getting the access information, because I think what you're talking about and asking about is a pretty broad issue, Ken. Now, once you get the access to the information or the technology, that's basically the very, very beginning starting point. With JAWS and I imagine many other forms of assistive technology, there's a huge component about how do you use the software, what functions do you need to learn to be a good and a nimble user of that technology. And NFB, many other organizations who are involved with this issue besides the NFB, ACB, AAPD, I think they all would say there really needs to be much more proactive training on these type of issues. And I would say it's been a real learning experience for me how to use my own assistive technology because JAWS requires very specific types of keystrokes. So, for instance, I'm reading an email from you, Ken, with my eloquence, maybe sometimes people say verbose sentences, and I have to use, say, down arrow and the alt key to read the sentence, or I can do a certain function to read a whole paragraph, or I can have JAWS just set up to maybe read a page at a time. And then likewise, when I'm typing, I prefer to kind of hear every word or every letter as I'm typing. But there's a various range of ways you can have it read it back to you.
And it's important to remember that a law school exam is a two-step process and that the text of the exam has to be made accessible, as well as the student then being able to have a means to record and review the answer the student's writing.
And then there's obviously some, I think a lot of the students would have extra time. I know that my colleague who just took the California bar, on top of using JAWS, I mean, I think the California bar is 3 days, so he took six. I mean, he gets double time.
Which was my experience. I did it over 4 days, 5 days.
And we have just enough time for our last two questioners.
My name is Ann Molk. I'm from William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota. I haven't had any complaints from our students, but I'm just curious what the feedback or the impression is of the accessibility of the legal research sites like Westlaw or Lexis?
That's been, I think, an evolving process. Lexis and Westlaw, I think, would both officially say that they're committed. Westlaw, I think from the experience of many blind attorneys, have at least back in early 2000 shown more commitments because they created a website specifically for blind attorneys. I think the feeling in the American Association of Visually Impaired Attorneys, however, is that that website geared towards blind attorneys is not up to date as would be the regular Westlaw site. And we're doing a journal on animal law and ethics, so we had a training for our editors yesterday. And I met with the Lexis representative, and she was kind of describing to me that they're really taking some more steps at Lexis to make their website accessible.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Allison Nickel, and I just happen to be the person from the Justice Department who did the Kindle work with the National Federation and Dan Goldstein's group. So this isn't really a question so much as it is sort of a solicitation of information. To the extent that there is a lot of kickback or pushback from the letter that's, you know, more serious than grumbling over the coffee machine, or to the extent that you know that either e-reader technology or the other kinds of technologies are being adopted as substitutes for textbooks or other methods of teaching, the Justice Department has a critical interest in knowing about that. We really see emerging technology in the educational setting as well as online learning courses to be a critical emerging issue for us. And so to the extent that there are anybody who has complaints about that, we can all be reached. And the letter also can be accessed at our website, which is www.ada.gov.
Thank you, and I might give one closing
word.
No,
just thank you. That was good.
And I want to thank our three panelists, including Sharon and Brian, were last day almost additions to the panel, and I want to thank all three of you very much for your help today.
Thank you.